Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hey everyone, you're joining me, Scott Helm. I'm here at GoTo Copenhagen, and you are joining me on this episode of GoTo Unscripted with Andy Greenberg. Do you want to give a quick intro?
Sure. I'm a senior writer for Wired magazine, and I write about hackers and cybersecurity and surveillance. And I guess most recently, I'm the author of this book, Tracers in the Dark, that's about, well, the subtitle is The Global Hunt for the Crime Lords of Cryptocurrency, and it's about the ways that people once believed that cryptocurrency was untraceable, the kind of perfect internet crime coin, you know, some people thought, including me when I first wrote about it in 2011, I have to admit. And then how over the decade that followed, many criminals of all kinds were quite surprised that it turned out to be the opposite, extremely traceable, and how this one small group of detectives used that to use cryptocurrency tracing to take down one massive cyber criminal operation after another over half a decade or so. Yeah, but please tell me about you, Scott, and what you work on as well.
Yeah, so I'm mostly independent. I work in the cybersecurity space, typically on kind of like application website security. All of the little projects that I started have kind of like grown into companies, including the one that I'm branded with, and they're all focused around how to help people improve their cybersecurity on their website. So to avoid, you know, nowadays data breaches is the really, really common thing. But we've also seen like digital skimming attacks where attackers will find ways to steal card data out of the page, or going back, even a few years prior to that, and hopefully we can touch on this later, you can mine cryptocurrencies on a website. So when you visit a website, your machine is enslaved into mining cryptocurrencies. And we refer to that as cryptojacking. And yeah, this, you know, going back into kind of 2014 through to 2018, that's quite a popular trend. So I'm interested to ask you actually about the anonymousness of these cryptocurrencies, because I think if I was to, you know, speak to people, certainly over the years, everyone kind of does think that cryptocurrency is anonymous, right? Like it's almost like a default belief, isn't it?
It's interesting for you. I thought you might say the opposite, because so many people in our world think like, Andy, how could you be so dumb as to ever have thought that Bitcoin was anonymous?
Within the tech bubble.
Right, like, exactly.
Within this
bubble that we live in. Yeah. You know, like Bitcoin was initially, even Satoshi Nakamoto wrote in this initial email to a cryptography mailing list that participants can be anonymous. And a lot of people took that very seriously. Can be, exactly. It turns out the only person who's actually managed that is Satoshi, pretty much.
Is the original person.
Yeah, because everybody else like eventually cashes out their coins or, you know, uses them. And they don't leave a billion dollars anyway, untouched as he or she or they have. So it has turned out that... Right. I mean, the larger, I think, community of even like people seeking privacy with cryptocurrency, there was a whole kind of cypherpunk movement that thought this was the kind of holy grail of secret money for the internet. And I think they were all quite surprised when in around 2013 or so, the first big paper came out that showed, no, you can actually start to find patterns in this blockchain thing that is, in fact, a record of every single Bitcoin transaction. You know, so now we look back like a decade later and it seems almost ridiculous. Like, how could you even think that this cryptocurrency underpinned by a blockchain that lists every transaction could have any anonymity properties? But, you know, they are just transactions between addresses, these pseudonyms, basically. So if it's not anonymous, it's at least pseudonymous. It just turns out that it's easier than we thought to find kind of threads through those pseudonyms and clusters of lots of different addresses that belong to single pseudonyms, and then to often, you know, kind of pierce the veil between someone's pseudonyms, their addresses, and their real identity. And that turned out to be incredibly powerful for law enforcement. You know, the story of my book is really about how these detectives use this as a kind of, you know, incredibly powerful tool to take down dark web drug markets, to trace stolen coins, like the Mt. Gox heist was.
Yeah, that was a big one.
That was cracked with cryptocurrency tracing. And it was, you know, 650,000 Bitcoins, which almost is like a mind-boggling sum today.
What was that worth back then? I was going to say, because that's quite a different sum from then till now, right?
Well, it was $500 million. And at the time it was discovered, anyway, it turns out it had been stolen years earlier and sold for like pennies on the dollar, of course. But then, it's still, those people who thought that they had money in Mt. Gox, they lost $500 million that they believed that they had in 2014. And it's funny to kind of see history repeating itself with FTX today, which not only has gone bankrupt, but has lost $500 million to hackers. I'm not sure if people have like paid attention to this story within the meltdown of FTX, but thieves actually stole on the day of their bankruptcy another $500 million of their money. So, but you have also, like, it's interesting that one thing that I really don't cover at all in the book is crypto jacking. And it sounds like you have done a major kind of investigation on this. Please tell the story.
It's a really kind of bizarre story in that I didn't set out to be involved in it, and it all kind of came around by accident. But I'll give like the brief backstory, and then I actually have a few questions that I want to ask you now about this story based on what you've just said already. So my focus, as I mentioned earlier, is kind of on securing websites and you know, how organizations can protect essentially their customers' data, because most websites is people putting their data in. And if there's some kind of breach, it's always like my data. So we've seen loads of attacks over the years where attackers will want to steal my username and password, or, you know, all of my identity information to then apply for loans or credit cards in my name and do your traditional identity theft. And then it became really popular kind of in the 2014 era, this thing called cryptojacking. And what the attackers realized was, it's like, well, hey, look, if we can get our malicious code into somebody's website, and normally customers would go there and will steal their username and password or their name and address. They were like, well, we're running code in the customer's browser. And like, if we're running code, we can mine cryptocurrency, because that's all that's required, right? You just have a crypto miner. And one of the most popular ones back then was from an organization called CoinHive. And they had a legitimate pitch for their product, which was, you go to a website and they subject you to adverts because they need to make revenue, and adverts are sometimes impact performance and they impact privacy. So what you could do is you could load the CoinHive mining library, and when visitors come to your website, you would borrow some of their device power to mine a little bit of cryptocurrency as a substitute for advertisements. So that was their kind of legitimate, you know, pitch, if you will. And unfortunately, that's not often what happened, because what people realized was, if I can set up, you know, CoinHive, but then install it on your website,
right,
maliciously, all of your visitors will mine the cryptocurrency, but then they'll send it to me instead of you. And this is what became known as cryptojacking, this hijacking people's devices to try and mine currency and steal it.
And did CoinHive take a commission on this? What was their business model?
So I actually don't know. I never used CoinHive officially, and I was kind of a little bit against it from the outset.
It's a bit of a sketchy
idea.
Yeah,
I struggled with my own comfort with the idea, and I'm sure that there's probably a way that you could have conveyed that and done it appropriately, but
I think most people, when they visit a website, don't expect their GPU to start, you know.
Yeah, exactly
up,
this. So I always kind of struggled with that component of it. And CoinHive specifically is one of the players were also a bit of a flash in the pan, because I think they shot to fame too fast, became used for cryptojacking very, very quickly.
Of course.
That brought all the wrong kind of attention in really large quantities. But these, you know, organizations, groups, I mean, heck, maybe they were individuals that did this, realized, you know, if we can get the mining library onto somebody's website, onto a big enough website, you know, then they have lots of traffic. We make lots of, and it was Monero that they were mining. We make lots of money. So they realize, you know, if we breach and attack an individual site, we get all of that site's visitors. If we breach this individual site, we get all of the visitors to that site. But then I guess they also realized, if we breach a dependency, and that dependency is used by hundreds of sites or thousands of sites, then we breach the one dependency, and then 1,000 websites load it, we've now breached 1,000 sites and we've got the visitors. And this particular one was a text-to-speech plugin. So it's a little JavaScript-like widget that you put on your page, and if you have a visually impaired visitor, it will read components of the page. And they compromised this company's servers, injected their malicious code into the dependency, and unfortunately, because it was text-to-speech and it was obviously very much around accessibility, government websites have very high accessibility requirements. So we found over 5,000 government sites that were loading this text-to-speech.
So this is a kind of like supply chain crypto jacking case.
Exactly that. It's like the two things together. You got like a super traditional supply chain attack.
Yeah.
And then the fact that they were going after cryptocurrency.
But it's sort of like a supply chain web attack too, which is like such an interesting, I don't know. It's like just a wonderful, like terrible series of events.
And this is the thing, right? Yeah. This is a wonderful, terrible series of events. I like that.
Well, it's really, you know, my thought about cryptojacking, yeah, I mean, it's like, well, I guess the scary thing is they had access to thousands of websites. Like, what could they have done if they weren't just interested in mining some Monero, right?
You know, like it's, and this got loads of media attention, especially in the UK, because I was actually notified about this issue from a friend of mine. He's like, you know, I've gone to this website and it's running really, really slow. And then like later on, my antivirus popped up this thing. And he's like, could you take a look? And that's actually how I started the investigation process, totally by accident on a Sunday morning. And eventually, of course, you know, the following days, we realized the scale of the attack and then different governments start getting involved in the remediation. And inevitably, you know, I spoke to the press and we did a really big story with the BBC. And one of the questions the journalist at the time said was, you know, like, okay, so they've mined this Monero, we're still trying to figure out how much, and maybe you can help me with that in a moment, but they were like, what could they have done? And at this point, it's like, well, I don't know, like, if you can think of it, then we can do it. Like, once you have the ability to just inject arbitrary code into the page, I was like, you think of it, and I will do it.
Well, the one that, I don't know, maybe the most disruptive thing would have been ransomware, right? I mean, I look at, that's the thing, like, crypto mining is definitely a nasty business. I mean, crypto jacking, rather.
Yeah.
Mining, I won't talk about the environmental effects or whatever. Yeah. But I do sometimes think like, well, that was a nice, like, peaceful era before it became more profitable just to hold these sites hostage instead, right? Like, it's, if I'm going to choose between, like, having everybody visits my site, spin up their GPUs and, you know, and, like, get annoyed.
Give me 4 cents in Monero.
Right. Versus taking my own website and server hostage and demanding, I don't know, whatever it is, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
The biggest scale thing here would be the visitors to those sites, you know, because, you know, we only managed to find around 5,000 government sites that were impacted by this. But then I guess like the even larger scale thing was like, what if they then turned that around and targeted the visitors to those sites? Because how many people go to you know, government sites on a day-to-day basis?
It's a kind of like beautiful attack to find this one plugin. Is that what it is? A plugin that then gives you thousands of sites, which gives you millions of
and it has to be millions,
visitors,
right? It's got to be and I have in the blog post and in the talk that I'm giving tomorrow, I actually cover the investigation into this. You know, I've got samples of all of the largest government sites from different countries, and it's like, you know, the UK, the US, Australia, New Zealand, you know, like really populous countries. So then they must have had lots of visitors to their, you know, to their website. So we're very lucky that really all they chose to do was mine some cryptocurrency, I guess, because it's a very short-lived attack. It doesn't have any lasting impact. You know, you go to the website 5 minutes, your computer's busy for 5 minutes.
Right.
But then when you leave, really all trace is gone. Whereas if they decided to download some malware onto my device or try and ransomware my device and then just charge me like, you know, even $10 multiplied by the millions of people that would have impacted, that would have been really significant.
Yeah, but I suppose it is stealthy as well. Like when ransomware groups have done, you know, large scale worms or WannaCry or something, then they make way too much noise. They, you know, it often doesn't even serve them that well. They end up with like FBI wanted posters with their names on it.
Yeah. I wonder if that's kind of what happened to some of the people involved in like cryptojacking, because it was such a flash in the pan. Mm-hmm. I always wonder, you know, they kind of achieved the notoriety, but then didn't have, you know, the plateau of success for a period of time. It seemed to literally be like flash in the pan and then gone.
Yeah. Well, I think it seems like some of them maybe moved on to ransomware, which is probably a more profitable, much more malicious in a way sort of business. I've also, you know, I am sometimes working on like stories about more of like the low level teen hacker community. And I recently heard a story about one guy who made enormous amounts of money through cryptojacking. It was never identified, never charged. I think he was probably even a minor at the time. So, like, not a minor with an O. Like, he was under the age of 18. Yeah. So, So I think that some people probably just got away with it too, because it is a relatively subtle, you know, profit model compared to ransomware or something like that.
And this is all of these attacks go back to, isn't it? Ultimately, like, they're here to make money, whoever these these people are. Like, I've not really seen any scenarios where there is an alternative objective other than how do we make some money? You know, so it's like, well, what can we do? And I guess the idea with the cryptojacking thing was, you know, this was actually found, like, we believe based on, obviously it's very difficult to look back after the fact, but we believe based on all of the evidence that it wasn't actually there for that long. But I guess, as you say, with it being like so subtle and, you know, essentially kind of undetectable to most normal people, you know, if they were there for days or weeks or months, I presume was probably their objective. You know, if you're getting millions of people to mine you a few cents here and there in Monero every day,
right?
Then, you know, that starts to sound attractive.
You weren't able to, like, pull together like an estimate of their profits. I guess the Monero is designed to prevent that, right?
Yeah. So this is one of the things that I did want to loop back to you on, actually. So cryptocurrencies, and you know, I understand the basic operation, and that's as far as my knowledge goes. And so obviously within the miner, we could see the address, and throughout the duration of the entire attack, where the money was being sent was consistent. So any of those, you know, would you call it a transaction when you mine it and then send it to the Monero wallet, they would have all gone to like this one consistent address. But that's not my area of expertise, so I never try to look into where did the money go? Or even if you could look, where did the money go?
Well, certainly if it had been Bitcoin, you could very easily, and if it was all going to one address, you could just see how much money had accumulated at that address. It's all sitting right there on the blockchain, you know. But I think, of course, like, the whole idea of them using Monero probably was to prevent that, because Monero tangles up its blockchain in all kinds of clever ways that I think obscures the amounts of transactions.
Kind of transparent.
It includes a kind of mixed network. I don't even know all of the features of Monero today. It has kept adding them, in fact, over time. I'm not sure where things stood in 2017. At one point, Monero was more traceable than it is now. In fact, some like serious vulnerabilities were found in it, but they were fixed. They might have even been fixed by the time of this, you know, campaign. But it's still super interesting to me to kind of like try to figure out how, I mean, because I've written a whole book about cryptocurrency tracers, I have seen a leaked Chainalysis being like, you know, the $9 billion crypto tracing startup. I've seen a leaked document that they presented to the Italian police. It was in Italian, that in which they claimed that they can trace Monero. And in 65% of cases, they can get a usable lead. And then another 15, they can find the sender, but not the recipient. But, you know, it's, nobody knows how they do that. It is almost certainly like probabilistic rather than, you know, deterministic. With Bitcoin, you can easily just, you know, find out whose addresses they are, find, you know, a cluster, and then just start, you know, adding up the values of the coins of those addresses. I think with Monero, it's far harder, but it does seem like there have been breakthroughs in Monero tracing in recent years, although Monero people really do not like me talking about that and get quite mad when I point this out. But in 2022, this case came to light. There was this $4.5 billion theft from the Bitfinex exchange, which you might remember.
I remember the headlines.
Yeah, the story broke like just as I was finishing the book. I kind of just mentioned it in the epilogue, but it's a crazy story in part because like the woman and this money laundering couple in New York, they're not just money launderers. They've now pled guilty to the theft itself too, but they were charged initially with money laundering. But the woman and this, you know, husband wife couple had posted these like incredibly embarrassing rap videos to YouTube. Do you remember this?
Oh, no.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, she called herself the Crocodile of Wall Street. You should maybe not check these out. I don't know. But they, at one point, they did some like clever things to try to cover their tracks, including they took a big tranche of the money and exchanged it for Monero. You can see this in the IRS criminal investigations document that was published with their indictments. And yet you can see that like after it's exchanged for Monero, the IRS just continues to draw the chart, like the money goes here and here. That seems to be kind of a giveaway that IRS can somehow trace Monero. In fact, you know, we know that they have a relationship with Chainalysis, that they use Chainalysis. They have in like some of the biggest cases in simply like the history of cybercrime. They use Chainalysis to bust, for instance, the first, second, and third biggest, to make the biggest seizures of not just cryptocurrency, but of money of any kind in law enforcement history in those years. So it seems very likely that IRS has access to this Chainalysis secret Monero tracing capability. It's still kind of frustrating that for people like you and me, we can't access that or figure out, see anything in the Monero blockchain. It's only the kind of people who can afford those five-figure Chainalysis licenses, I guess, who can do that.
And is it down to like what we call the OPSEC, the operational security of the person using the currency in terms of like how anonymous you are? Like, I assume there's things that you can do to improve your anonymity.
I'm sure that you could like layer something else on top of Monero so that when you cash it out at an exchange, even if the exchange has your know your customer identity, you know, exchanges have to collect identifying information on their users. So the idea is that you use a coin or a laundry system so that like once you cash it out, you're not connected to whatever criminal thing you did with the money because your identity is at the exchange. But I imagine the people who use Monero think that it's safe to just cash it out directly at an exchange because it is itself a kind of money, you know, it is, I don't want to say it's a money laundering system, but it is a coin that like is designed to mix up everybody's coins together and make them harder to trace so that you could safely cash out your coins without, you know, any sort of connection to a criminal event. It just seems like there is nonetheless some way to trace those coins. And that is kind of like the whole story of cryptocurrency to me is it's like sets this trap. People once believed that Bitcoin was anonymous and therefore it kind of like seduced all of these people seeking privacy and cyber criminals of all kinds for a decade, pulling in like all sorts of nasty businesses from drug dealing to child sexual abuse materials networks. And then all of it actually was exposed by the fact that the blockchain actually records every single transaction and is quite transparent. So it seems like in some ways the same thing may be happening, I don't know, to some degree with Monero too. We'll just have to see what cases come out of it. I remember seeing, in fact, like when I wrote about the use of Monero in that Bitfinex theft case and the fact that it seemed to me that IRS had traced it, some Monero people, you know, on Twitter got very mad at me. And then others responded, well, we'll just see who gets arrested. And that's how we'll find out like how true this is. So I don't know. I would not want to use a privacy tool where the way I find out if it works or not is if I'm arrested.
But, yeah.
You know, that seems like that's where Monero's, you know, kind of capabilities are at today.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if, because I'm sure I'll have the address somewhere in my notes. And to my recollection, I don't think I published it. But it would be really interesting to see if there's any way to look back at that even now. I assume nothing would change over time. We either can or cannot.
Right. I mean, blockchains are forever. That's like part of the problem with using them for crime is that when somebody develops a new capability years later, they can go back in time and excavate evidence from that blockchain. Yeah. And the criminal cannot go back and erase it. It's gone, you know, it's out there forever. So that's true of Monero too, I'm pretty sure. So it would be interesting. Maybe like I can, you know, put you in touch with some Chainalysis people who might be willing to do this.
That would be interesting because we've never, from the original breach, obviously through to the, you know, the remediation steps and then the long-term solutions that were implemented as well, I've never seen anything come back to the headlines. I've never heard of any even kind of, you know, criminal investigation that might have looked at who was responsible for this. And,
really?
And there was this like one Monero address sat there on the page throughout this whole breach and it was on all of the government sites.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, it would be fascinating to just know how much they made with this, but then also to identify who was behind it would be, you know, kind of
that's
incredible the one that coup. Yeah,
I'm curious about because we had a lot of discussions around that at the time, you know, and given, you know, the nature of the attack and how the attack was done, and then also once they had this capability to do anything that they wanted and they chose to mine Monero, it was either, you know, the kind of the two guesses were somebody quite sophisticated that just wanted to remain undetected for a long time, or, you know, perhaps even like a miner, like you said earlier, someone that just stumbled, you know, across this and thought, oh, this would be cool. You know, it was really hard to pin exactly which angle that it was coming from.
Yeah.
But if it had been someone truly with like malicious intentions, there's 1,000 other things that they would have done.
Yeah. Although the use of the plugins to get so many sites, that does seem like somewhat pro to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. For all of these ransomware cases too, cryptocurrency tracing usually is capable of identifying who, you know, who pulled off these, you know, terrible crimes to with kind of amazing exactitude. Like, you can see, Chainalysis anyway seems able to see every layer of these organizations based on their cryptocurrency transactions. But the problem is they're in Russia, and like, what do you do with that information? You can help to, I don't know, indict these guys in absentia or sanction them in some cases. But if they're kind of beyond a political border, then it doesn't really matter if you can identify them. It would still be fascinating. And yeah. And I kind of imagine that your person in this CoinHive thing is, as well, is most likely not in a Western country or an extradition country, but nonetheless, it'd be really interesting to see who did it, if you could do that tracing to pull it off.
I'll dig out the address, because it will be in all of the, because we were, like, throughout the event, we were recording the payloads to see if there was any involvement in the attack.
And then the question will be, like, would Chainalysis or somebody else want to show that they have a Monero tracing capability? You know, there might have to be some parallel construction involved for anybody to actually give us an answer.
Anything useful on that? Yeah. But it would be fascinating. And, you know, the kind of the weird thing as well, obviously, CoinHive fell off the map a little bit because, you know, obviously speculation from the outside, but, you know, maybe they were a bit of a flash in the pan because they brought a lot of attention. And this whole kind of crypto jacking thing, I guess, was ultimately really damaging for their proposed brand and product. And we did see, like, other minor variants of that, but now the attackers have just moved on to things that are even more profitable. I assume they weren't making huge amounts of money mining Monero in a browser. You know, it can't have been enormous amounts. I bet the play was long term, you know, a few cents multiplied by a million a day or something.
Right. I just wonder if, like, the curve of, like, processing power necessary to mine any significant amount of cryptocurrency has moved to the point where crypto jacking doesn't work anymore. Is that the deal?
There's also that. I think that might have been one of the big reasons for Monero as well, because it's much more friendly to be mined in that environment, which is CPU-based mining. And back then, you couldn't do GPU-based mining in a browser like that. So I think that was possibly, again, speculation, but I think that was possibly one of the reasons they went for Monero, because it was more friendly to the circumstances that they found themselves in. So, yeah, I think nowadays you're probably absolutely right. It would be irrelevant. You know, the amount of money that you could actually yield with that, it just wouldn't be worth the risk.
Which may be part of why we've seen all these criminals switch to ransomware instead, which is sadly, like, a much more disruptive thing for society and schools and hospitals and governments. Yeah.
It has been fascinating to watch it evolve. You know, this criminal empire, however we want to refer to it, whatever. These people, or do we call them organizations, people? You know,
I think that they're definitely organizations. I mean, they have org charts and bosses and office hours, it seems like. I don't cover ransomware too closely. My colleagues at Wired do, and have broken some great stories based on the leaks of internal communications of groups like Conti and TrickBot. And they complain about their, like, kind of working conditions and just, like, talk about what they're going to do on the weekend. It seems like just, you know, in an extremely, like, kind of organized and boring work-life way. Yeah, they are really, I think they're, like, practically corporations, you know.
Well, you can jump on if you get ransomware now, you can just jump on and speak to support, can't
That's
you?
Right.
They'll help you know, they'll help you decrypt your files after you paid the ransom. I was quite surprised to see that. I forget which group it was, but yeah, basically life support. You know, it's like, okay, you paid the ransom, you need some help decrypting all your stuff, you know, jump on with a support agent. It's like, wow, this is, this feels like, you say, more like a criminal empire than some group of, you know, some small group of people or something like that. Now we're far beyond that, aren't we?
Yeah, and there really just doesn't seem to kind of be an end in sight. I mean, it's been depressing for me, having, like, written a book about this incredible power of cryptocurrency tracing, to see that, you know, it really cannot solve this problem. You know, I think that even Chainalysis is very clear about that. You can use it to try to find the kind of off ramps to where these criminals are trying to cash out, basically, to liquidate their profits, and those exchanges are being sanctioned and shut down. But speaking of mining, there's, like, we've even seen, like, some of these criminals now feeding their coins into services where you can rent mining rigs and then mine clean coins. They mine clean coins with the dirty coins as a means of laundering. And there always seems to be, like, one more laundering trick that's available in this kind of cat and mouse game that enables this ransomware epidemic to continue.
And they must have the amount of you know, resources, money, essentially, at their disposal now. I remember a talk recently by a chap called Mikko Hipponen.
Of course, yeah.
And I'm just, it literally just sprang into my mind then. And I'm sure that they were looking and saying, like, basically, how, you know, how far away are we from, like, a $1 billion criminal enterprise? And he kind of did some analysis. And he was like, well, actually, you know, if the attackers and the groups that pulled off these heists did nothing and then just held the currency for this many years, they already have $1 billion just because of the phenomenal growth in the value of Bitcoin since some of these earlier attacks. And he's like, you know, so you think about that. We're not talking, you know, organizations, criminal organizations with millions of dollars or tens or hundreds of millions. He's like, you know, we could have a criminal organization out there with $1 billion at its disposal.
Yeah. And well, it's like, you know, I guess that's it's a crazy thought, but I, you know, as I said, like the IRS pulled off these three cases, one of which was two people in New York City who had stolen, I think it was 120,000 Bitcoins at the time that they stole them. By the time that the money was taken back by IRS, or about like 80% of it was $4.5 billion. So that is a two-person operation that was a separate criminal unicorn, you know, and several times over. The second and third biggest cases that the IRS pulled off, I mean, the second and third biggest seizures of money in law enforcement history, one, but actually both of them were hackers who had stolen money from the Silk Road, the dark web drug market, early on.
That was a big story when that got busted, right. I remember that.
There were two, in fact, of these hackers who, before the Silk Road was taken down, had found perhaps the same vulnerability in the site where you could, I think it was actually maybe as simple as like, just like entering negative values, you could like increase your balance and pull Bitcoins out of the site, basically. And
both so, like, buy a negative quantity of an item and essentially get a refund.
Or maybe as a vendor, I don't remember what the actual vulnerability was. I'm not sure it's ever been fully made public. But each of them amassed tens of thousands of Bitcoins this way. And I think they were both smart enough to know that if they tried to cash out these giant sums, they were more likely to be identified. So both of them sat on these coins for years and years until each of them had billions of dollars worth of Bitcoins at the exchange rate at the time in 2020 and 2021 when they were caught. I mean, IRS criminal investigations traced their coins even though they didn't spend them. These poor guys, you know, they sat on these coins for years and years.
And you're not even making interest on Bitcoin, are you?
One of them like had, you know, I think 70,000 coins in a popcorn tin under the floorboards of his closet, you know.
Wow.
And that's billions of dollars. I think he did maybe cash out like just enough of it to kind of live large.
Didn't buy a green Lamborghini and get himself caught that way, did he?
I think there are photos of him, you know, in saunas or like hot tubs on yachts and things. But this poor guy, he then has his whole stash seized and he's now facing prison as well for hacking the Silk Road itself, a criminal site. It's just a bizarre story. But those guys, each of them, were essentially like one-man, billion-dollar cyber criminal operations. I mean, the world of crypto is just, numbers are so bizarre that, it doesn't surprise me at all that Mikko did that math and found, I mean, I'm sure ransomware groups, some of them, if they held on to like a few tens of thousands of the Bitcoins that they were making early on, are billion-dollar operations.
It's just so much money for
it is.
An organization like that to have at their disposal. It makes them unstoppable.
They could bribe anyone.
Anyone. Yeah.
So do you think it's very scary?
I've seen a lot of kind of speculation around the long-term prospects for cryptocurrency as a whole, obviously. And I used to play around with mining like back in the early days when it was actually viable to mine on a GPU. I've always been a gamer. I had to play around with my GPU. And, you know, back in the days when Bitcoins were 5 cents, you know, less than a dollar. And now, and I don't actually know the present day value, but I saw a peak of like 34,000 US per Bitcoin. Was that?
Oh, it was much bigger than that. The peak, it was like 75. Now it's at 25 or so. I don't hold any Bitcoin. I'm not like interested in like investing, but I did, I don't know. I track it in part just so that I can like, I don't know, keep up with what, you know, this, do the math to talk about like the, so this many Bitcoins were seized, which is worth this much. When I first wrote about Bitcoin in 2011, it was worth a dollar. And I tried to buy about 40 Bitcoins For $40 at the time. And I put in this like transaction on Mt. Gox, the only exchange that existed back then. And it didn't go through because like Mt. Gox was so buggy and terrible. And I just gave up. And I try not to think too often about like how, you know, I guess, well, I'm doing it right now, but it'd be like $1 million today, right? 40 Bitcoins.
Wow.
Wait, is that right? 40. I don't know. We'll do the math later, but it's a lot of money. And I regret my lack of persistence in just doing that like simple transaction.
I always see the kind of the famous tale of buying a pizza for 10,000 bitcoins.
And right. But you were there, you're saying, when you were mining them and they were worth cents.
Yeah. So, yeah. Like, and I have like distinct memories of like 5 cents and 8 cents a piece. And
what did you do with those coins?
So I used to hold Bitcoin. So, and I hate talking about this and I don't really talk about it, but I sold out when they hit $100.
Yeah, I would have done the same,
you know,
I'm sure.
It was like,
and you probably thought that you were brilliant. I mean, you were. Like, you made a huge return on your investment. Right?
And then you look and think, you know, you never look back, right? Never look back, never like sit there and do the kind of, you know, 2020 hindsight thing. But yeah, I was like, this is crazy. This is wild. You know, these things that some of them, you know, were in getting up to like the single, you know, dollar value per coin. But yeah, I was pretty much out of everything at like $100 a Bitcoin. And then I've only dabbled and played since then. There was another coin that got released called Shiba Inu,
really?
It was called.
Yeah.
And I was
not
just like,
Dogecoin, but
no,
another
yeah, like
Shiba related coin.
Yeah. And I was like, I'll buy like $100 and sell it 3 days later for like $400 or something.
Really? Wow.
It was just like a bit of fun at that time because I was still kind of.
Shiba coin is actually worth like $75,000 today. Did you know that?
Wow, no.
No, I'm just joking.
But, no, okay, cool. I was about to start crying on camera. but is it here for the long term now? Like, is cryptocurrency now, you know, has it got over its kind of crazy fluctuation period and we now have like a bit of a, you know, like a long-term stability there?
I've never like been terribly interested in like whether Bitcoin is going up or down, although everybody's interest in my writing about it is like completely directly correlated to the price of Bitcoin sometimes, I noticed.
But that's just because the criminals want the valuable thing, right? Like,
well, yeah. I think that for them, they don't actually care terribly much whether the cryptocurrency is going up or down in value. They actually just probably want to cash it out pretty quickly. And for them, it is this, if not the untraceability, it's the uncensorability of cryptocurrency, that it's very difficult to. In some cases, it is, you know, it is untraceability they're seeking, whether or not that is makes any sense at all. Very often, it doesn't. You know, they have this illusion of its untraceability still. But I think in many other cases, it's just like the same thing that makes Bitcoin helpful for like sending remittances. You can send money to Ukraine very easily with crypto. It makes it easy
versus the traditional banking system. It has to be much more flexible, surely. You know, to
when the Ukraine war broke out, we saw like, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars sent to Ukraine with crypto. And at the same time, donations were being like frozen and seized in people's PayPal accounts. So it really did show its purpose there in some ways. But that is also what I think often why criminals like it too, because when the ransom is sent, it can't be recovered, you know, even if you can trace it to its destination. So I think that they don't, you know, for them, it's just like a means of transaction. It's one of the very few people who actually use crypto for that purpose.
Yeah.
Most other people, I think, are still buying it as like a store of value, right?
I was going to say, like, if we do analysis on, given like the public ledger nature of Bitcoin, you know, is there that transaction volume there that suggests day-to-day consumer use or, you know, like, is there a...
I'm not sure. Crypto boosters definitely like to say that it's there, but I mean, when was the last time you saw anybody spend crypto on anything?
Well, so this was literally the thought that was going through my mind then. You know, we were promised, you know, Bitcoin payment cards and Bitcoin ATMs and everything else.
And that didn't work out. And neither, neither has the anonymous money thing. You know, it's not digital cash in either of those respects. It might be digital gold.
And aren't the transaction fees now mega significant? Again, I don't follow the kind of day-to-days, but
it seems like they are. Yeah,
it seems sounds like very expensive to
people
pay.
Talk about it as like, you know, perhaps it's a layer one and you do these like different kinds of transactions on top of that are lower transaction fees, but it doesn't, certainly is not like what I remember, like going into a cafe in Berlin and like you can buy Bitcoin, a beer with Bitcoin. That's not happening as far as I can tell anywhere.
I do a good bit of travel, you know, we're sat here right now in like Copenhagen. I get around, certainly around Europe a lot. And I have to say, and usually in capital cities, which is probably the best chance of seeing a Bitcoin ATM or a bar that accepts Bitcoin for a beer. And I can't say I've ever noticed it or seen it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. But, you know, you and I, it's now at $25,000. Like, I think most of the media would say that that's low, which is shocking probably to you and me. I've seen it at a dollar. You've seen it at 8 cents or whatever. And to us, that's like, holy, you know, that's so many orders of magnitude larger than I ever thought it could be. That's, you know, that as a reality check, it's like, wow, it's actually been incredibly successful. But then everybody covering like the FTX trial or Sam Bankman-Fried's trial, which is just starting this week, they see us as being in a kind of like, you know, FTX inflicted crypto winter where Bitcoin lost 2/3 of its value, but 2/3 of $75,000. Whereas, you know, the numbers, I think, to people who have been around like since, you know, you and I started looking at crypto, it's still, you know, just shocking. And if it doesn't feel like winter if you start at 8 cents and end at $25,000.
Yeah, for sure. And I think I'm going to have to go and dig some photos and things out now because I've never really, you know, paid too much thought back to those days. And I like to try and forget about the
also,
fact that I sold it all.
Are you sure that you didn't? Like, I would just be almost scared that I left a
wallet
somewhere.
How many times I've been through my hard drives? Yeah, I was just literally thinking the same thought pattern as you then. It's like the amount of times when I've dug out like my old wallets and I'm like, I'm just going to double check I didn't leave 3 Bitcoins.
Exactly.
In some forsaken corner. But I remember back in the day as well when you could make like cool Bitcoin addresses with your name at the beginning. So like my Bitcoin address is like 1 Scott and then all of the usual, because there was like a little tool that would make a Bitcoin address for you with your name or some other string in it. But yeah, that was a long time ago. And I remember the rig I was mining on was super, you know, basic. It had a really like RTX 10 series card in it back, whatever they were called back then. So, you know, this was, God, it must have been like the late 2000s, I'm sure. Yeah, I have a feeling in my mind it was like pre-2010.
Was 2009, I guess. Like, yeah. I mean,
so maybe a little after. I don't know when because there was a period when it was just worth nothing for, you know, for a good time there before it even got into like the tens of cents in the dollar. Yeah. So it was definitely early on and I should have stuck in it.
Yeah. But I've interviewed Hal Finney, who was the second ever user of Bitcoin after Satoshi, you know.
Wow.
And he was dying of Lou Gehrig's of ALS at the time. He was fully paralyzed, could only respond to me with like eye movements, his eyebrows even. He could not even use his like eye movement based keyboard very easily at that time. But I interviewed his family too. And I mean, the poor family, like they sold like most of their coins pretty early, but then they also, he was mining so early, I mean, ridiculously early, like before anyone but almost like him and a few other people in Satoshi knew what Bitcoin was. And, you know, his wife was like, why is the computer making so much noise? Can we just turn this thing off? You're just doing this as like an open source project. Just turn it off, you know, and just imagine, you know, the value, like the wealth that they generated and then like, you know, stopped generating. But I don't know, that's probably everyone's story in the early days of Bitcoin. You can't like, his poor son was like quite, you know, kind of caught up in this feeling of like what could have been and the, you know, how much money they could have had. But Hal Finney was an incredible guy and he left an amazing legacy just by being there so early on and writing a lot of the early code of Bitcoin wallets and things too. So sorry, we've gone a long way from
interesting. I'm sat here kind of like fascinated by the story almost, but I think we're probably pushing close to time there, so we should look to start wrapping up. You're going to be speaking soon, actually.
That's right. I'll be giving a talk about the book tonight. And you're speaking tomorrow?
Tomorrow morning, yeah. So are you on the party tonight? So it's like 5 or 6 p.m.
I'm like dinner entertainment, I guess.
Nice. Like that. And I'm tomorrow morning. I think I'm the second talk, so that puts me kind of like 11, cool. 11 in the morning.
I'll check it out.
Kind of time. But yeah, it's been
Fascinating awesome. To talk about this stuff.
I've read many of your, you know, stories online over the years. Obviously, the cybersecurity world, we overlap a lot, so... Awesome to meet you in person.
And the next time you like come across a crazy thing happening on a Sunday, call me instead of the BBC, all right?
You got it.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.